During this time, it's more important than ever to support our friends and neighbors in the restaurant industry. Restaurant Workers Community Foundation has set up a national COVID-19 crisis relief fund. The money they raise will provide direct relief to individual restaurant workers, support other nonprofits serving restaurant workers in crisis, and offer zero-interest loans for restaurants to get back up and running. Visit restaurantworkerscf.org to donate today. And if you need a little extra motivation, you can DM your $20 donation to RWCF's co-founder, John DeBerry, on Twitter, and he'll give you directions for making a signature quarantine cocktail. Donate now at restaurantworkerscf.org.
Hello, and welcome to Hungry Society. I'm Quercia Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today, I'm talking to the brilliant Carla Vasquez. She's a food writer, a recipe developer, and a food stylist who's based in Los Angeles. Carla's writing has been published by the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, Teen Vogue, and Eater LA, among other publications. And her recipe work has been on BuzzFeed Tasty and Tastemade. But this show is about her passion project and her business, Salvi Soul, which she founded in 2015. Salvi Soul is a Salvadoran cookbook storytelling project that's focused on recipe documentation, cultural memory, and intergenerational healing for the Salvadoran diaspora. And it's currently the only dedicated food platform for Salvadoran cuisine. She hosts weekly online cooking classes, events, and she's even working on a forthcoming cookbook. I wanted to talk to Carla because the work that she's doing, while it's rooted in food, is actually about placemaking and centering Salvadoran women in the stories of the Salvadoran diaspora. She said something that stuck with me since we spoke. She said food is sometimes the only way we can touch a place that means a lot to us. I think that's so true, and it makes her work of documenting Salvadoran foodways that much more important because while she's connecting to the food and the place, she's also providing a through line and a through way for other Salvadoran people to connect to El Salvador too. I hope you like this conversation, and I hope you check out her cooking classes that she's offering now and through the summer. Each week, she takes on a different Salvadoran dish and talks about its history and shows you how to make it from start to finish. The lineup is incredible. So there's a class on pineapple vinegar, cooking with yuca, and pastelitos, which I'm in particular really excited for. They're only $25 each, so it's a great deal. She'll tell you more about that and her work in the conversation that follows. Thank you for listening, and thank you to Carla for sharing her story. Okay, so we are here with Carla Vasquez of Salvi Soul, this amazing, amazing website, and cooking classes and entire brand. I'm so excited to talk with you today, Carla.
I'm so excited to be here. Thanks so much for having me, Quercia.
Thank you. So one, your site is awesome. I love how you talk about Salvadorian culture, but you also like kind of bring readers along with you as you talk about how cooking and getting together on a dinner table is so foundational to you and why it's so important, and like hearing your family's stories was always a part of your experience of eating together. And I think that's just so, so beautiful. First, I want to talk a little bit about how Salvi Soul came about and, you know, why you started it.
Yes. Excuse me. Yes. So I started Salvi Soul in 2015, and I really wanted to just make a recipe that my grandmother makes. Like it was as simple as that. I really wanted to make salpicón. And so I messaged my grandmother and I said, you know, Malusi, can you teach me how to make salpicón? I really want to make it. And she said, yeah, of course, you know. And then she also said, you know, but why don't you know how to make it? You've lived with family for many years, that you should know how to make this. And she was very gracious, but it did kind of, you know, put this question, like, why haven't I learned? Or, you know, let me see what resources there are. Why haven't I just learned all of these different recipes that I grew up with? And I started just doing some research on what kind of cookbooks were available. And I was just completely surprised, disappointed, disturbed at the fact that there were only two cookbooks at the time that I could find. And one of them was a book that was self-published, and she had sold out of her books. So if you wanted to buy that book, which was in English, you'd have to pay $150 or more, because it was doing really well in the secondary market. Yeah. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, what? This is absurd that there are so many Salvadoran folks in LA, in the United States, you know, across the globe. So many of us have a transnational identity where we want to keep our roots alive, but we're also trying to adapt to the many countries we've had to move to. So I was completely shocked. And so it was that little bit of I want to say it was this combination of, well, this is wrong, and also I really want to make this recipe, so let me, you know, start talking to my grandmother. And I started talking to her, and what happened was very beautiful. As soon as I started spending time with her in the kitchen and documenting her recipes, it was just natural that her life story kind of surfaced as well. And it wasn't so much the story I had heard, you know, through my mom or through family, where they maybe saw her as a victim in her story. It was her sharing it with me, saying, Carlita, these were the choices that a woman in the 60s had available to her. And I found that so empowering. And she stopped being someone that was a victim. She started being this hero of the story, and she started being this resilient character that laughed, that fought, that cooked really good, and, you know, just had this life that I don't think I would have been able to see it that way had I not spent that time in the kitchen with her. And of course, like, none of this surprised me, because the storytellers in my family, like, they're all great storytellers. And, you know, hearing these stories were so nourishing to me as an immigrant who, you know, going to El Salvador isn't always an option. It isn't always easy to go back. And I always had this craving and this insatiable kind of desire to know more about the land that we had to leave behind, and to kind of have, you know, those identity questions that a lot of us immigrants kind of struggle with, like, where do we belong and how do we feel connected to those places? So I got a lot of that through these stories that my grandmother shared. And then, of course, the food is nourishing my body. It was just like, oh my gosh, I feel all this nourishment, all this culture. This is amazing. And so that just, you know, led to the next step, which was asking myself, well, maybe I can start doing this with my mom. And then eventually I pitched it to a few friends who were the only Salvi friends I had growing up. And, they, you know, when I pitched it to them, they said, oh my gosh, Carla, I've been wanting to figure out a way how to document my mother's stories, because, you know, what she went through was so profound, and it's that sacrifice that she made laid a foundation for what our families have been able to do. So just, it felt like this was resonating with a lot of folks. And yeah, so I started in 2015, and in 2017 I was able to dedicate more time to it, and I chose to pursue Salvi Soul full time. And I did an open, or a call out in the fall of 2017, and it was at the beginning of October, I believe. I had 6 interviews, and by the end of November, I had found 25 women who were all willing to talk to me so I could, you know, document their recipes and document their stories. And it's now 25 families who have really entrusted me to document them, you know, so that we don't forget what they've gone through, so that their sacrifices, their stories were not in vain, you know, so that we can all learn from them. So, yeah, that was kind of, I don't know if that was a long-winded answer there.
No, that was perfect. You said so many like amazing, beautiful things there, but the two things that jumped out to me is how cooking with your grandmother and learning these recipes, you know, being centered in her own story moved her into, you know, more of a hero in your eyes. And I think with writing in particular, for me, I'm always asking, like, who is at the center of this? And, you know, am I trying to speak for this person, or am I letting this person speak for themselves? And I think that that's such a crucial, crucial part of trying to tell people stories and trying to, you know, uncover stories in particular. And I also love that your grandmother called you out, like, why don't you know how to make this, you know, at first, because
Grew
up with it, you know, and, you know, we take these things for granted, these amazing, like, cultural legacies that we're given. And I think it's so interesting that your grandmother called you out at first.
You know what? I'm so glad you bring that up, because I do think that there is a dynamic that is kind of like a double-edged sword for a lot of immigrants like myself who want to learn and are hungry for this knowledge. But I also think that on the other end, what I've realized now after having interviewed 25 women who are all amazing Salvadoreñas, and they are fierce and they are knowledgeable and they will put you in your place. But I've also learned that they're very guarded. And, you know, we think of the kitchen as being this very romantic place where there's flavors and, you know, there's just magic and alchemy and all these beautiful things. But it's also a place of efficiency. And so many times, you know, I hear the women share stories, and, you know, they are the ones that are rounding up their families. They're the ones who are caring for everyone. They have, you know, so many different hats that they wear for each of their family units. And so, of course, you know, they are kind of given the burden of culture practitioners and cultural bearers. But that last little bit of being able to be cultural, like, sharers maybe is too much to ask, because they have so much that it's hard to kind of carve out a space and say, okay, we are going to go over the ancient technology of making tortillas, you know? Like, that's just not afforded to working class women who are doing so much for their families. And that's just, like, when we're talking about what they're doing at home, you know? Forget talking about all the hurdles that face women of color outside of the home, right? So it's kind of crazy that, yeah, of course, you know, it's hard to get that. And also, I think that when I've had folks ask me, you know, how do you recommend that I approach my family so that they can spend time with me so I can document a recipe? I have to tell them, like, you need to value the work the same way you would value the work of, say, you know, a really famous chef who's teaching a masterclass. You're asking them to give you decades of experience of burns and scrapes and ingredients that, you know, maybe had to be tossed because something failed in the recipe, and you're asking them to give it to you in an instant. That's not going to happen. That's an unfair ask of your mother or your grandmother. You have to say, I'm going to pay for the ingredients. I'm going to pay for a foot massage after, because you're going to teach me. I'm going to take care of you from beginning to end. I'm not just entitled to what you know. I'm here to care for this food knowledge. So that means caring for you also. And so I think all of that goes unsaid. And it's only because I've been doing this work now that I'm now privy to all these undertones and these layers that are also kind of happening as we talk about, you know, preserving our culture.
Yeah. So for listeners who aren't familiar with like the influx and the kind of wave of Salvadoran immigration to the United States in the 80s, can you briefly talk about that?
Sure. So during the 80s, there was a civil war in El Salvador that lasted 12 years from 1980 to 1992. So naturally, there were a lot of people who fled El Salvador due to safety reasons, being persecuted by both sides of the conflict. And my family was definitely part of that group that decided to leave because it was safer to venture out and walk thousands of miles to a place they'd never known than to stay home to what was familiar. So there's a huge community here in Los Angeles that is Salvadoran, and the only other place that has as many Salvis is El Salvador. So the community here is definitely a large one. And there's plenty of enclaves all throughout the United States. Houston, Brooklyn, Chicago, and we're starting to see a lot more enclaves also in places like London, Paris, Australia too. So there's Salvadorans everywhere. Japan, Abu Dhabi. Someone messaged me from Abu Dhabi also. So
wow.
So we're kind of forced into a transnational situation.
Yeah, I'm curious if you've noticed, like, as the cuisine has moved as well, like, have you noticed any sort of, like, regional differences in any dishes, like, as people move to LA or Houston or Chicago?
You know, that's a really interesting question, because I do see some regional differences. I also want to say that we're at the beginning of kind of seeing that trend, because I think that a lot of the restaurants that, you know, settled here in the 80s and 90s, and there were even some before in the 70s, a lot of them just focused on traditional food because the migrants who were here missed home. And so there was no kind of messing around with it. It was just, this is how we make it in El Salvador because this is what folks want because they miss it. Now that you see folks, you know, who are second generation or one and a half generation, they're kind of wanting to see something different, something exciting, something that, you know, kind of moves and evolves with them, something vegan. And that's kind of, it's been fun because there's some pupuserias here in LA where, you know, they're making pizza-sized pupusas, and they're making fruit pupusas. And pupusas wow. is the national dish of El Salvador. And it's a thicker tortilla that's stuffed with, you know, all kinds of ingredients like cheese, beans, meat. And like I said, there's a place that does fruit. And it's very delicious. I really love it. But I'm also seeing a lot of restaurants who are not Salvi, who are also using Salvadoran dishes and, you know, doing things that maybe, you know, kind of irk the Salvadoran community, that make the Salvadoran community upset. Because it's, you know, we talk about...
Yeah, I was going to ask if there's some friction there.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, for so many of us, food is the way we touch home. It is the only way that some of us can feel like this is where I'm from. And even for me, like, food is the way that so many of us touch home. And for me, growing up, I constantly longed to understand El Salvador. And the only way I was able to understand it was at the dinner table with these stories and these dishes. And so when you see someone who hasn't had to carry that burden, hasn't had to understand what it feels like to long for home, and the only way you can touch it is to sit at the table and enjoy this meal with others who understand it, you know, when you see them kind of take creative permissions that maybe don't belong to them, and they do it for, you know, to be interesting or to give their customers something that's exciting. It doesn't feel good, right? It doesn't feel like it's thoughtful. So I definitely understand those feelings. However, I also understand that food, in order for it to be something that walks with you, has to kind of evolve with you. Otherwise, Salvadoran cuisine will only belong to the grandmothers and mothers who I've talked to. And, you know, I've heard it say so many times that cuisine often is like a time capsule. You know, these are the foods that we were eating at this time. And so I also want, you know, when I talk with other Salvis, I also say, like, but let's give ourselves some creative license to play. You know, we've had to survive so many things. So let's give ourselves some permission to play and to imagine what these flavors would, you know, taste like if we mixed it with this, or if we just evolved a little bit to see what's possible. So I do believe that we are going to start to see more adaptations, more regional differences within the cities where there are Salvadorans, because it just kind of feels inevitable that, you know, it just feels inevitable.
I think what you said about cooks and chefs taking creative license with ingredients and dishes that they haven't carried the burden of using them as trying to connect to the root. I think that's one of the best ways I've ever heard the frustration of like culinary appropriation described. I think when people hear like, you know, when people use words like authenticity and traditional and, you know, all this, and people immediately, their first reaction is, oh, wait, if I'm not of that culture, I can't make it. And it's like, no one's saying you can't make it. It's just your connection to it is completely different than someone who is sitting at the dinner table, like you said, because they long for a taste of home. They literally want the foods of where they come from. It's just a completely different connection to ingredients and dishes, and I've just never heard it put the way that you put it, and I think that that's so just astute and poetic and beautiful.
Thank you. I think often poetry comes from a lot of pain and a lot of understanding, and a lot of Salvis are actually, it's a joke that Salvis are really sentimental, because there's so much angst, and there's so much like collective trauma, and so much, there's just so much. And I think that food has been a vessel to kind of understand some of those feelings, intergenerationally also. You know, like, it's sitting at the table with my parents, I can hear their angst about having to be survivors of war, of knowing, you know, here I am eating, you know, a sopa de gallina, you know, a chicken soup. And my mom sharing, like, this is what it was like being a 15-year-old and waking up and seeing dead people, you know. So I think that for the Salvadoran community, there's a lot of feelings. We catch all the feelings.
Nothing wrong with that.
I know.
Yeah. So you have this like really great line on your site that talks about how documentation is power. And I'm going to read it. Documentation is power. It's what affords permanence and ubiquity. And I'm wondering if you can expand on that idea and talk about specifically how you use that idea to like inform your work with Salve Soul.
Yeah, absolutely. That, when I wrote that, what I was thinking about was an experience I actually had in cooking school. And it was the week where we were going over eggs. And one of the students in class, you know, kind of just raised her hand and said, why, you know, asking our instructor, who, by the way, is Korean, and she was Middle Eastern, I believe. She kind of said, why is it that we always start talking about French terminology when we're talking about cooking? Why is it so prevalent that we say omelet and saute? Like, I don't have to explain that it's an egg pancake. You already can see in your mind's eye an omelet. And I thought it was such a great question. You know, the whole class just kind of leans in, waiting for, you know, this answer. And the instructor finally, you know, after thinking for a minute, snaps her fingers and says, I know why. And we all just kind of lean in closer. And she says, it must be because the French were the first to document this process. And of course, now there's probably more to that story. But that day, in that moment, and hearing her say that, it rocked my world. I thought, wait, that's it? That's all it takes is to have ubiquity, to have access, to see your culture reflected back to you? That's all it takes is to document it, just put pen to paper. And of course, you know, when we talk about documentation, a cookbook is not the only front that my community is fighting. You know, I had a professor once who said, where you sit is where you stand. And documentation as a whole is an issue that we're fighting as a community. Documentation for status in this country. Documentation to, you know, not be separated from your family. All of these things are issues that we have on so many fronts. And so what I am really trying to do is document our stories in every single way I can, on Instagram, on the blog of my website, in this hopeful cookbook, to try to control what we see of ourselves out there so that we can see a reflection of ourselves, and we can say, I like what I see. We are a beautiful people. We have so much to give. We're not just war survivors. We're not just, you know, what we are minimized to for the sake of, you know, a newspaper article. We have so much. We are so much. So the whole idea of documenting is so that we can access that power of ubiquity, so that when I say pupusas maybe 20 years down the road, you know, people just automatically know what this is. It's no longer a question. It's no longer a long explanation of me explaining, you know, my food history or my food culture to you. It's just, it's accepted, and it's seen as, you know, this is beautiful.
Yeah, I relate to so much of what you just said. I try to do the same thing with Black foodways in this country. I think a lot of our culinary history is oral, and it's like kind of, it's passed down. And I think, you know, I tell people French food isn't inherently better. It's just that they had more time to write things down. And to create like a kitchen brigade system and to identify like this is this cut and, you know, label all these different terms and put it in books and practice it in like different structures and in restaurants. And, you know, it doesn't mean that that food is inherently better. There's skill and tradition and a depth of knowledge in Black food ways as well. It just hasn't been documented. And so as a writer, I find it, you know, I find that to be one of my goals is, you know, am I adding to the documentation that someone, you know, next year or 10 years from now or 20 years from now can look at and say, oh, there was a Black chef or a Black family doing that, and what can I add to it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had folks who have said to me, we need to still keep these oral traditions alive. Like, a cookbook shouldn't replace that. And I definitely agree. I think that we can afford to have tools, and a book is a tool, so that if we do keep, you know, having a lot of oral traditions within our cultures, let's celebrate that. Yes, let's do that, because that is how so many stories of resilience have been, you know, passed down. However, there is so much that is lost if we don't care for it. So I always tell people, like, please still keep doing what you're doing and making those phone calls and getting on WhatsApp video calls with your mom. Like, you don't have to follow recipes exactly, but they're there for you if there's something that your mom can't answer, or if there's something that, you know, your community isn't sure about. You know, that the hope is to give us more tools so we don't get lost.
Speaking of WhatsApp and being connected,
yeah.
I want to talk about your Zoom cooking classes. So you focus on a different recipe with each class, right?
Yes. I started doing Zoom classes in April, and I, you know, it's kind of crazy how things happen. I initially just put out Salve Soul on the internet, just taking up space. That was the goal. Take up space on all the platforms so people know there's someone out there doing this, and if they want to connect with me to have me interview their mom, wonderful. But once people got a hold of this, a few folks said, you know, we want to touch this now. And there was just demand to access this now. And I thought, you know, I don't have a book deal yet. It was just a wonderful and frustrating, you know, challenge. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll host cooking classes and people will like that. And I started hosting in-person classes, and I was only able to do about 8 to 10 people at a time. And then, you know, COVID happened, and quickly trying to pivot and trying to figure out, how do I still serve my community who still wants access to this? And, you know, through suggestion of a friend and just kind of feeling like, okay, let's try this out, I thought, let's put up a class for every week. We're going to do a Salve recipe every single week for a month in April, and we'll see what happens. And folks just loved it. I was getting people from Japan, like I mentioned, folks from all over the world saying, oh my gosh, I can finally take your class now. I've been dying to take it. A person from Boston just last week who was in one of my classes said, I really had been wanting to take your class since last year, but I can't come to LA. So thank you so much for hosting them on Zoom.
Wow. That must feel so good.
Oh my goodness. Yes. It feels so validating, and it feels like, you know, the community is taking care of Salve Soul with me. We're both fighting for it because we both know what it means, right? And I've had, when I had in-person classes, I had someone who drove from San Francisco to LA to be a part of the class. I had someone who drove from San Diego to LA to be a part of the class. So it's just blown me away. And, you know, in the class, they're usually about an hour and 15 minutes. Sometimes we go a little over. And I do go over the recipe. I go over, you know, relevant facts about, you know, how to make this, the techniques. But then what I love most, and what, you know, a lot of the participants love most, is I dive into some of the food history. we talk about some of the politics that surround a certain recipe or ingredient. You know, we talk about what this meant for the diaspora, how it's changed, for, you know, how this recipe has changed from what it is in El Salvador to fulfilling the needs of the diaspora here, you know, in the U.S. And I quickly started to see that these classes are not regular cooking classes. It's a hub for Salvadorans to connect. And so there are times where people just kind of jump in and say, you know, I used to make this with my grandmother and she's from a certain part of El Salvador and they make it this way. And it's so interesting to hear this because, you know, we're often told that if it doesn't look a certain way, then it's not Salvadoran. And so there's this whole kind of new world of like, are there regions in El Salvador that do things differently? Yes. But we have been able to access that conversation because, you know, of several different reasons. But it's just been a beautiful space where Salvis can come and ask questions and connect with other Salvis across the world. And then it's been also cool to see, you know, a few folks who are not Salvis, but their spouse is Salvi. And they'll say, you know, my husband's mom passed away and she really, you know, this dish that we're going to learn today was her, you know, the dish that he loved most of hers. So I want to make it for them. So it's definitely more than the recipe. It's the whole culture that, you know, we're talking about. And I look forward to them all the time. And I'm always, after the end of every class, I'm always like, wow, we're doing it. Like, we are really connecting. We're taking up the space. We're feeling stronger because we were doing this work together. It's just an amazing feeling.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. So where can listeners find out like more information about your Zoom classes? Where can they sign up?
Yeah, so the Zoom classes registration and the schedule is on salvisoul.com. And it's a, yeah, it's got, there's a list of classes, all of the summer schedule is up. And I'm working on the fall schedule right now. So yeah, everything is on salvisoul.com.
Oh, that's great. Can you give us an idea of like what dishes are coming up and like what dishes you're thinking about for the fall schedule?
Yeah, absolutely. So what's coming up this Sunday, we are doing a class on rellenos de whiskey. And it is a vegetable dish that is super popular in El Salvador, but you will rarely see it in restaurants here. If you eat rellenos, it's because your mom makes it. And it's a vegetable that's stuffed with either cheese or meat. And it's covered in an egg batter and then fried and finished in a tomato sauce. We also have a class on pineapple vinegar. Pineapple vinegar is used in a lot of different recipes in Salvadoran cuisine. Let's see what else. We have a class on empanadas, which in Latin America, empanadas can refer to, you know, a pastry that's filled with something sweet or savory. But in El Salvador, it's actually made from a mashed plantain that's stuffed with a custard and fried. Yeah, so those are coming up. And in the fall, I'm still kind of, I'm having fun with it, kind of trying to figure out what folks want and also just doing things that I think would be interesting. So doing a class on different kinds of atol, which is a hot corn-based beverage, and potentially doing another baked good, semita de piña, which is a pineapple sweet baked good. So lots of things.
Wow, that all sounds really, really good. I'm speaking of, you know, cooking food that we took for granted growing up, I'm making stewed saltfish, plantains, and Johnny cakes tonight. And I'm very excited and like thinking about dinner already. as you were talking, I was like, maybe I'll start dinner like right after this call.
I know what you mean. It's torture sometimes, like trying to think of or trying to just do food writing and trying to do recipe development. You're just like, oh, I'm just hungry all the time.
Right. Great. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more with Carla Vasquez.
Restaurants employ over 15 million people nationwide, and 2/3 of all restaurants are independently owned and not part of big chains. Yet, currently, these small businesses are not represented in government relief negotiations. ROAR is working to change that by fighting for relief opportunities for all restaurants. ROAR is advocating for an 8-point plan in New York State that will allow restaurants to reopen and rehire when the time comes. Dozens of industry leaders have signed onto this plan, like Namwa Tea Parlor, Field Trip, Momofuku, and many more of your favorites. You can join them at change.org by searching for ROAR, Relief Opportunities for All Restaurants.
All right, so we are back with Carla Vasquez of Salve Soul. And now we're going to get into a bit of, you know, we're going to talk about the role that dining has played in your life, which we have definitely already gotten into, but we're going to tease it out a little bit. So you talked about, you know, at how at the dinner table, there was always, you know, the stories of your parents and your grandparents. But I'm curious what was on the table. Like, what are some memorable things you remember your family cooking?
Let's see. So one of my favorite foods that, excuse me. So one of my favorite foods that I remember eating a lot of was mojarra frita. So it's a giant piece of fish and it's fried and everyone gets one whole fish for themselves. And I remember as like an 8-year-old feeling like, oh my gosh, this Saturday, we are having mojarra frita. And it was just such an exciting feeling. Like, yes, it's going to be like a chill day. And we're going to have the vegetables. We're going to have rice, tortillas, everything. It was just an exciting meal.
Wow. Also,
yeah.
So everyone would get a whole fish?
Yes, a whole fish. And I remember my brother and I, we would trade, like, I couldn't stand the head of the fish. And so I'd give him the head and he'd give me the tail.
Nice.
And one of the things too I remember was that my mom had a rule, like if you wanted mojarra frita, you needed to make sure that you were like a responsible eater, which meant that you weren't going to be talking because there you have to look for the bones and you don't want to be choking on bones. And I remember telling her, like, Mom, I will be good. I will eat very slowly, and I will make sure that what I'm eating won't have any bones. She's like, okay, if I can trust you with that, then we will make mojarra frita. I was like, you can trust me, Mom. and so it'd often be, like, we'd all be really excited, but kind of eating in, like, silence. Like, we have to be careful that we're not going to choke on any bones, otherwise we won't get this again. Which is like a pretty brilliant plan if you're a parent and you have kids, like how to have a meal at peace.
Yes, that's very smart of your mother to do. Yeah. And also getting fish bones like trapped in your throat like really, really sucks. So she did you a favor.
Yes, yes, yes. But yeah, I mean, the weekends were big eating days for us as a family. You know, we'd do cleaning in the morning, calling family in the afternoon, and around dinner time, I knew my job was to set the table and kind of help her with, you know, salad or beverages and putting it all out there. And if we had family coming over, this is when they'd, you know, show up. And then it was eating and story time. And sometimes I really dreaded the stories because, you know, there'd be something that from what we were eating that my parents, it would jog their memory of something or a funny story or maybe a sad story. And without any disclaimer or anything, they would just start sharing. And I remember there'd be a few times where my cousins or my brother would slowly kind of disappear. But I would just stay there. I loved it. I loved it. It's just like I wanted more. I'd get seconds just to kind of hear them talk a little more. Like, so tell me more about this story that, you know, when you got caught running in the coffee fields because, you know, you were doing some naughty thing. I couldn't get enough of it.
Wow. Like you've talked about how formative that would be, but even just like hearing it secondhand, I can only imagine like how foundational that would be for a family and for a child to hear.
Yeah. And, you know, now as I reflect back on that time, I think about how important it was also for my parents to share who they were, to maybe decompress about something that they'd been carrying. And without realizing, you know, we were both helping each other carry this burden of not being able to be in our homeland. You know, them sharing with me is helping me feel this void I feel I have. Me listening to them is helping them express themselves when, you know, they were work, night school, parenting, everything, like doing so much and trying to survive and keep their heads above water. So I think of those times and I feel so grateful for them. I know that my parents worked hard to, you know, carve out those spaces, a dinner time, and especially like Saturday dinner times were so important. And I'm so grateful to them for maybe without even realizing how important they would be for me as an adult now. They were pivotal.
Yeah. So I want to know what you're looking to right now for inspiration. Like, are there specific books, music, art that's kind of keeping you inspired right now while we're all at home?
Yes, I feel like I am consuming so much because I'm home and I just finally have time to watch shows I've had on my watch list or read things. But some of the things, I'm reading a lot of cookbooks, things like Zaytoun by Yasmin Khan, Downtime by Nadine Redzepi, reading some Central American anthology, watching really cool shows like Little Fires Everywhere and Never Have I Ever.
I haven't watched that yet.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. I was sad it ended, and then everything else I thought to watch after I finished that was just a disappointment. Like, oh, it's not Little Fires. And as far as like listening to music, I think I've made a playlist that I've called Fuck Them. Can I say fuck on your show?
You can swear as much as you want on this show. Go awesome. For it.
But I think I've just had a lot of disappointment with this journey in pitching my cookbook and then being told that, you know, the American public won't understand it. And I'm saying, I am the American public. I want this. I get it. Plenty of us. Plenty of folks who look like me get it too. So I now listen to a Fuck Them playlist, and I have things like I Am the Game by Motorhead. That kind of just puts me in a, like, you know what? We are just going to be best because my people deserve to see themselves in something beautiful, and fuck anyone that doesn't get it. Just fuck them. I'm done with trying to explain it to folks who don't want to see it, who don't want to understand why it's important. So I listened to that. And then for some laughs, I've been watching that Nailed It show.
Oh, yeah.
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 I wouldn't normally watch that kind of show, but Nicole Brier is just so brilliant and hilarious, and she gives me laughs that I didn't know I needed. So I watch that. That keeps me pretty happy.
That's a great combination of things to be taking in right now. I especially love the Fuck Them playlist. I think I might copy you and do that for myself.
Oh, please do it. Oh,
there are plenty of times where, you know, you get a rejection or you get, you know, well, tell me about why this Black chef matters. And I'm just like, fuck you.
Yes.
So, yeah, I definitely need that playlist.
Yes, it is. I recommend it. I can't tell you how many times I've just like, you know what? It's going to be fine. I know how to take care of me now. And I need to just remember that I'm here to do something that is hard to understand, apparently. So I know why I'm doing it. But yeah.
Yeah. So my last question for you. So on the show, I ask every guest, you know, what their last meal would be and who's invited. But I have since updated that to be what kind of dinner party, if you could host any kind of dinner party, what would that be like? What would the atmosphere be like? What's served and who is there?
Oh, wow. I would definitely, this is a fun, speaking of play and imagination, this is my type of question. So I think I'd want to invite, chefs from Raiz Restaurant, which is a pop-up. Raiz is a pop-up in El Salvador, in the capital of El Salvador, San Salvador. And it's a group of chefs who are brilliant. They are defining contemporary Salvadoran food. And what they do is beautiful, and it is nuanced, and it is dignified. And one of the saddest things about, you know, COVID is that I was planning a trip to El Salvador to eat there, and, you know, can't, all the travel is canceled. Yeah, but yeah. I would love for them to be the folks who kind of, you know, present a magical meal. And as far as who's invited, I would definitely, one of the first people that I'm thinking of is a YouTuber. Her name is Adela Alvarez, I believe. And she's one of the first YouTubers who started doing Salvadoran recipes. And what is so beautiful about the work she does is that she will often go to El Salvador and she'll just bring her camera. It's her and her sister. And they are talking to a lot of the women who, you know, are making tortillas on the side of the road. And, you know, she's just doing a lot of this, like, guerrilla filmmaking and wow. A lot of, you know, food anthropology without a fancy title. And, you know, she will always finish talking to them and say, you know, I have, you know, I have little packages of makeup that if you want, they're free. I just want to know how I can care for you. And she does this all because of her YouTube base, who help fundraise so she can do this.
Wow.
And I just think that that's a perfect way of, you know, illustrating to folks, like, the Salvi community wants to care for the Salvi community. We know that we need each other, and I just think she's such a badass person, and I want to meet her, and I want to just chat with her and say, like, how has this been for you? Like, you know, how did you get this started? Like, I want to hear your story. So definitely her. And there's probably, if I think about this long enough, I'd probably just fill the table with a ton of women who have been pioneers in food and who have, you know, had that fuck 'em attitude. I want to eat. I want to be at a table with a table full of women who've had fuck 'em attitudes and who have done the work and been excellent. It almost doesn't matter who else is there. As long as they're women with that fuck 'em attitude, it would be a great dinner.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds amazing. I'm going to go look up that YouTuber. Can you say the name again?
Yeah. The name of the YouTube channel is called Cocina con Adela.
That's amazing. Yeah, where can listeners find more information about you, about Salvi Soul?
Yeah, so Salvi Soul is on all the socials with the same handle, Salvi Soul, SALVISOUL. And folks ask me about Salvi, what does it mean? And it's just a contemporary word for the generation of Salvadoran Americans who find themselves here in the U.S. And then I'm also on all the socials, Carla T. Vasquez, on pretty much all of them.
Oh, that's great. I can't thank you enough for being on the show. And I just listening to you talk, there's clearly so much passion and so much knowledge. And it's clear that you just want to share that knowledge with everyone. But you also want to honor and respect the traditions of Salvadoran cuisine. And it's just, I can't thank you enough for being on the show.
Thank you, Korsha, so much. This has been a dream to talk to you.
This program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.